Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, the issues being raised by Marissa Mayer of Yahoo and Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook are these top corporate women pushing other women employees into old male models. Plus, Supreme Court watcher Linda Greenhouse, as the justices hear a challenge to the Voting Rights Act today. And we'll talk about food traditions around the world, including the eye-popping new study suggesting the Mediterranean diet prevents heart attacks and strokes much more than anyone would have guessed. And we'll get going after I wish you a happy Procrastinator's Day. It's the last day of our winter membership drive, and if you haven't done so yet, please take a minute right now as you listen to become a member or renew your membership in WNYC at 1-888-376-9692 or online at WNYC.org. And for this last morning of the membership drive, I can announce that we have the last and only the second matching period of the drive on The Brian Lehrer Show. A group of listeners like you, and I love this, has pooled some money above and beyond their memberships to create an additional matching fund for this last day of the drive. And we want all that money that's available to us to actually flow into our coffers. So please, we ask all our regular listeners to kick in something to help pay the bills. Those other listeners will match whatever you pledge right now with another 50% of your pledge. So pledge $100, we'll get $150, et cetera. Please join or renew right now as the drive is about to end, and we have the special member matching challenge, only the second and certainly the last matching period on The Brian Lehrer Show of this membership drive on this final day. So help us out, folks. Kick something in to help us run the radio station in 2013. 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692, or pledge online at WNYC.org on this last morning. Thank you so much for doing it. Now, as we speak, the Supreme Court may be hearing arguments in a challenge to the Voting Rights Act, which requires that a number of southern states and various other locations, oh, by the way, including three boroughs of New York City, get preclearance from the Justice Department before making any changes in voting procedures that could abridge the right to vote based on race or color. Why might this hallmark of racial equality in America be hanging by an Anthony Kennedy thread? New York Times columnist and former Supreme Court correspondent Linda Greenhouse has been wondering that and joins us now. Hi, Linda. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Happy to be here.
And at issue here is Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So by way of background, what is it and why does it apply not just to Jim Crow legacy communities like Shelby County, Alabama, which is the plaintiff in the suit, but also to three boroughs of New York City, Manhattan, Brooklyn, and the Bronx?
Well, the act came in 1965, and at that time there was a formula that denominated which states were going to be, quote, covered, the covered jurisdictions. And that had to do with had these jurisdictions reached 50% voter registration, had they reached 50% voter participation in presidential elections. Congress then expanded the formula in 1975 to pick up jurisdictions with substantial number of non-English-speaking voters to make sure that election materials were available in other languages, and some other tweaking of the formula. So it's not so much a regional thing at this point, but various jurisdictions around the country, including Alaska, for instance, meeting various markers.
The plaintiff in this case is Shelby County, Alabama. What do they want?
Well, I'm going to back up a bit because I did hear the newscast at the top of the hour. So what does Shelby County want? Really, I think you have to sort of walk it back and say, what does a very aggressive conservative movement want out of this litigation? Shelby County didn't wake up on some sunny morning and said, let's bring a lawsuit to challenge the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. It was recruited by an outfit, a one-person outfit called the Project on Fair Representation, which is backed by a lot of conservative money. This is a movement case. And I think that, you know, without understanding that, people don't really get the idea. So what does Shelby County want, ostensibly?
And what does the movement want, ostensibly? Because it's good that you put it in that context.
Yeah, well, what the movement wants is basically to get rid of obstacles that this statute puts up to disenfranchising or making it very difficult to vote for people who the conservatives would rather not have voting. And you know, we saw this in the last election. We saw voter ID laws coming in. We saw last-minute restrictions on early voting. We saw lines hours long, and so on. And
so you see this not so much as a constitutional question, but as a partisan gambit that is now before the justices of the Supreme Court?
Well, yes, if you want to put it that way. And I also want to take issue with the way this case has been cast in many of the news accounts as it was at the top of the hour, sort of a policy debate. So on one hand, you know, you have the Attorney General of Alabama saying, well, it's just unfair because Jim Crow is in the past and we shouldn't have this troublesome law anymore. And then you have an African-American spokesman saying, yes, we need the law and we shouldn't turn back the hands of time. I mean, that's a policy debate that's for Congress. That's not a policy debate that's for the Supreme Court or the federal courts. And Congress had this debate in 2006 when they renewed the law, which had a series of expiration dates. They looked hard at Section 5. They held 21 days of hearings. They compiled tens of thousands of pages of record as to what was actually going on the ground.
And I can't wait till you get to the numbers in the vote.
Yeah, the U.S. Senate unanimously voted to reauthorize the law.
98-0 in the Senate.
Right. And in the House, I think there were 30, 33 negative votes.
I've got it as 390-33 in the House. That's
right.
Still in the Republican Congress of 2006.
Right. And obviously from those votes, the senators and representatives from the so-called covered jurisdictions, the 16 states, voted to reauthorize the act. In fact, the state of Mississippi has joined New York in filing a brief to the Supreme Court saying, keep the law alive. We still need it.
And you mentioned in your opinionator column in the Times last week that in one of President Bush's final acts in office, he urged Congress to uphold it again. However, isn't the whole point of the Supreme Court to be an independent judicial wall against political consensus if what's popular violates people's constitutional rights, like when it was politically popular to allow discrimination against blacks?
Well, yes, if you put it that way. I mean, that's not quite the dynamic that I see in this case. I see this case as a question of the extent to which the Supreme Court will or will not defer to Congress when Congress enacts legislation under authority specifically given to it by the Reconstruction era Congress in the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection, and the 15th Amendment, which guarantees the right to vote. Both of those amendments have sections that explicitly say Congress shall enforce these guarantees by appropriate legislation. So, of course, the word appropriate carries a lot of weight, and the Supreme Court historically viewed appropriate as giving Congress a very wide berth. In recent years, it has scrutinized congressional action under the, quote, appropriate, that's Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, scrutinized it more closely. And that's the trend that sort of brings us to the door of the Supreme Court being rather likely to strike down one of the signature civil rights acts in American history.
But on what grounds? If this is the partisan gambit that you portray it as, and Congress has made its will on this issue so very clear, what's the constitutional basis for the argument, even if it's being used as an excuse?
Okay, so the constitutional basis comes down to the Supreme Court's interpretation of what is appropriate legislation, appropriate enforcement legislation under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. That's the section that gives Congress the authority to enforce the guarantees of equal protection and due process. So going back to the Rehnquist Court in the late 1990s, early 2000s, the court, as I suggested, was taking a very skeptical look at what kind of scope they were going to give Congress in carrying out its enforcement authority. And they were cutting back on this and basically saying, unless you, Congress, can show that there's a current problem that is so serious in the equal protection area that it demands a proportionate congressional response, we're going to say that you've exceeded your enforcement power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. And the court did that in the area of religion and the area of discrimination against people with disabilities, in the area of discrimination in employment on the basis of age. They've never done it with anything that has to do with race. And after all, race and racial equality was the core project of the 14th Amendment. So coming that close to the bone, to the core, is why this case is really as much about the role of the Supreme Court in 2013 mm-hmm. as it is about civil rights.
So in our last 30 seconds, what's your analysis? You seem to be guessing that the Supreme Court may in fact throw out that section of the Voting Rights Act. Is this another one of these issues that is now all on Anthony Kennedy's shoulders?
Well,
because the other eight votes are easy to guess?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think they all have an obligation to, to grapple with this and not pass it off to Tony Kennedy. But I think, it's important to realize that the court had no need to take this case. The lower courts upheld the law, as you said, and this would be a completely self-inflicted wound. There was no need for the court to intervene in this matter at all.
Supreme Court watcher Linda Greenhouse, formerly Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. Now she writes about the court in the Opinionator columns and pages of nytimes.com and in the paper. And Linda, thanks so much for filling us in on this case as it unfolds this very day in Washington. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, the issues being raised by Marissa Mayer of Yahoo and Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook. Are these top corporate women pushing other woman employees into old male models? Stay with us.